Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Andrew Warner. Andrew is an absolute legend in the podcasting game. He's someone I listened to probably in high school and college briefly, and he has been podcasting and posting interviews for the past 10 years. So when the opportunity came for me to interview him, I jumped on the opportunity, and that is in part due to the fact that he's got a new book coming out, which we'll put down below. You can click it and check it out. But if you would like to see the video version of this podcast, you can go to youtube.com/Danny Miranda. And I also included for this episode the pre-show conversation that I have with Andrew, and you could check that out at youtube.com/Danny Miranda. As always, I appreciate you tremendously for listening. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. And if you have any thoughts about this episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. That's all for me. Let's get right into this episode with Andrew Warner.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Andrew, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's an absolute pleasure. I know how much of a legend you are in this space, so I'm grateful that you are taking the time here today with me.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So let's start off on your journey at NYU. And I was reading your LinkedIn in preparation for this conversation, and you said your activities and societies were sitting in the library and quietly reading about entrepreneurs I admire.
It's true.
I wasn't big on organized student activities. So first of all, why'd you put that in your LinkedIn? Second of all, What did you learn from sitting in the library all those years?
I put that on LinkedIn because I was starting to feel as an adult that I wasn't alone all those years. And I think I was still feeling bitter about being made to feel alone, to be the only person who cared about that stuff, for being in a college where I was paying out of my pocket. I got no money from the school, no discount, paying for all that. And they were accommodating people who wanted to go and have a party, accommodating people who wanted to hang out this, hang out there. They weren't accommodating people like me who came in with an ambition to do something. And I felt really alone. And I felt maybe I'm really banking and investing my whole life in this idea that there's something else out there. And I have no proof that it exists. And maybe I'm actually going to spend it all on like my whole life on this. And so that's why I did it. And what I got out of it was, it wasn't the work itself. It was in the moments when I couldn't go back home to Queens where I lived, and I didn't have a dorm in Manhattan where my school was, and I was exhausted out of my mind, but I would fall asleep at the desk, but there were points before I could fall asleep where I had nothing else. And they had these old bound copies of Manhattan Magazine. And I just kind of liked Manhattan because it was so vibrant back then. And I went and I read it, and it was full of these stories of, frankly, rich people who'd done interesting things and their freaking quirks. And I found other magazines like that. I think Manhattan Magazine never made it. Maybe, was it Manhattan? If it's not that exact name, it was some random thing that was super polished but never made it. But it had a really good perspective that I liked, and it gave me a sense that there's something else out there, that there are people who are quirky by design, who are who they are and are better for it because they have their quirks. And it made me realize it's okay to bank everything on this future that I have in mind, because number one, that's who I am. I'm not someone who's going to want to go get drunk and be proud that I passed out the night before, the way other college kids seem to be. And number two, that there is this life that I'm at least aiming for. And you know, once you know what the target is, even if you don't hit it, it just gives you a lot of clarity about what you're doing.
It's so interesting because at that time, it seemed like I was, you know, you're talking about 2000, let's say, the year 2000 or even before then. It's like entrepreneurship was not something that was put on a pedestal. Today, everyone's an entrepreneur. Everybody wants to be an entrepreneur.
I'm going to say, actually, you're right about back then. I think the world is turning. I think there was a period there through the early Y Combinator years, the early like dot-com, well, not dot-com. Dot-com did do it, but it was more like the Web 2.0 years where everyone wanted to be an entrepreneur. People are moving away from that. It's too much work to be an entrepreneur. You have to be too obsessive. It's too much numbers and lack, and a lot of it is an anonymity. I think we're all getting into the creative world. Everyone wants to be a star on whatever social platform. It feels more fun. It means that someone else does the number work for you. It means that you get a lot more attention. I think that, guess what? If you're into entrepreneurship, you're going to be back to being a nerd and a dork for the next few years. And there'll be a few people who will point out to Elon Musk and say, you're not really an entrepreneur because those are the real entrepreneurs. And sorry for being such a loser. I don't get what you do. But that's okay because we are made this way to be entrepreneurial. And I think it's frankly just okay because the outcome and the projects are just fun in and of themselves.
It's interesting that society shifts in that way.
Yeah.
Whereas like Gary Vaynerchuk talks about how in the 80s or 70s, there wasn't a word like entrepreneur, starting a business, and that was considered weird. And you know, you get to today and it's commonplace and much more accepted and known in the lexicon. It's why do you think society shifts and moves in this way, and where do you see it going?
I've learned that it's not all society. It's American society. We think that American society is the society because to some degree it is. I had my eyes open where I started to travel outside the country and realize that the world is different. I'll give you an example. We were in Argentina. My wife and I lived there for a year, and we went to people's homes. Teenagers weren't angry at their parents. Parents weren't like befuddled by teenagers. Teenagers would come home and just have barbecues, their asada with their families. It was, and I just took it for granted that you go through a period where you don't relate to your parents and you have to fight against them in order to find yourself. But it turns out the rest of the world doesn't see that. The problem is that American society is so pervasive that it starts to make us in America think that we are the only way, and we start to think that everyone, and then everyone else starts to think like us too. So another example is, I think it was when we were in Argentina when we saw a Black Friday sale. And a Black Friday sale is basically the day after Thanksgiving when stores in the U.S. have their sales and they break even, right? They're in the black ink. Other countries just adopt it blindly because the U.S. is so culturally dominant, they become it. So what I'm trying to say is, in the U.S., we have this belief that people who are business people, hardworking people, are boring. Maybe they're takers. If nothing else, they're just not living an exciting life and all that. And we're going to go back to that because that's where we are. We're much more and always have been about celebrities. Everybody really wanted to be Frank Sinatra in his age, and nobody wanted to be Frank Sinatra's record publisher or the person who was running, what was it, CBS Records, whatever. There's like this sense that we want to be the face. We want to be the rock stars. Thing is that I don't believe the rest of the world feels that way. You're starting to see in countries, I did 7 marathons on 7 continents, and I interviewed entrepreneurs in every one of those continents. I remember sitting in Singapore and seeing that they weren't aspiring to be the next social media star, or next television star, or rock star. They were aspiring to be really good at their jobs, really good at school, really good at something that their parents would be proud of. Now, is that me? No, their lifestyle is not me, but it shows me that there are other approaches. And I think that anyone who's listening to you, anyone who's following your work, they have this determination to do something different. I think we're now at a place where everyone's like cheering us on and congratulations, phenomenal, great. But you know what? I think in a few years, we're going to be kind of running alone with nobody cheering us on. And we have to remember that we are here because there's a certain passion, a certain need to create, a certain need to aspire, that's what we're about. And it's that, and not so much that now society's coming around and later they're going to go away. And frankly, an American society is great for a lot of things, but one thing that it doesn't do is really admire the builders.
That's interesting, because I think in many ways we do admire the people who build stuff. What do you mean by that?
I think that if you ask the average person how many entrepreneurs they know, how many inventors they know, they're going to give you fewer than a dozen combined. If you ask them how many performers they know, they could go deep into the dozens and dozens, deep into it, right? And that's the difference. We're not really in admiration of the builders. We're in admiration of the you know, the performers. And to some degree, my job with Mixergy has always been to turn entrepreneurs into performers, to help them understand that they have to show who they are to a broader world that should be following them, that culturally we're better that way, that they have to step into that role. I remember reading about Frank Sinatra. I used to listen to his records, and I remember listening and reading old material about him, and there was a sense of cool about him, but also there was a sense that his music wasn't that great. And if you go back and you listen to his music compared to other people, I don't think he did that much better job, if at all, compared to other musicians. But what he did was he brought cool into it. He was going to step into a room and be a presence. Beyond the music, he was going to have a lifestyle that you'd want to at least read about, if not emulate, that you cared about his music because you cared about him, the person. And I think that other entrepreneurs need to start to step into that. And I think we're seeing that, and I think we're going to keep seeing that. And those are going to be the rising stars. The fact that the pool of fans that adore them is going to shrink, and I think it will, shouldn't stop us from doing it, from stepping into that role, from being more like Frank Sinatra than, frankly, Tony Bennett, right? Tony Bennett was a great singer. For his whole life, he was nobody. It wasn't until his grandson, I think it was, got him on MTV that and said, now you need to be the cool older man who comes in with these popular standards. It wasn't until then that he became a thing. Frank Sinatra became cool. He had a lifestyle. He had a personality. He had wives. He had these things. He had hangers-on. Get TV shows, movies.
Yeah, so it sounds like your job at Mixergy was to tell these stories in an interesting way. And in doing research, I found out that you actually went through the hero's journey with people before the interview, and you eventually got to the point where you were taking these entrepreneurs that you were about to interview and having them outline their story in such a way. And I was like, wow, that is dedication. Do you still do that to this day?
And we do. It's not me personally.
Yeah. So take me through that process and why you decided to create that, even though it was, I'm sure, a decade ago.
You know what? I used to think that good conversations just happen when two good people meet, or when someone just has some kind of magical touch. And maybe there are people who have a magical touch. My guess is that there are very few of those, and most people who we think have a magical touch have a process that either they know or they don't know. And I said, all right, I can't just hope that this works because I'm recording, and if it doesn't work and I have to say to the guest, sorry, this sucks, I got to cancel it, it's an embarrassment for them, but also I should be ashamed that I wasted their time. And so I said, all right, what are those key moments that separate things? I'll give you one, and I know you're going to take this, that you're not going to take this personally, so I'll give it to you as feedback for you. Now that I'm on this side of the conversation where I'm being interviewed, I realized in the beginning of the conversation, I had some anxiety. And it wasn't anxiety about, will I be able to talk? Am I going to be okay? Is this going to be fun? It was anxiety about, will I let Ben, who runs the publishing company that's publishing my book, Damn Gravity, will I let him down by not mentioning the book? Did Danny mention it in the intro that I'm going to hear afterwards? Will he mention it afterwards, right? And it was like all this anxiety, and I had to still it and say, just be here in the conversation. If it doesn't work out this time, we don't mention the book, that's fine. We could talk about it next time. I learned that there were guests who I would interview who were so aggressively promoting their stuff that I would have to bat them down and say, stop promoting. We're not here to listen to your sales pitch. We're here to learn from you, and don't worry, I will tell people that you're hiring or that whatever you're doing, or that you launch a new feature. I had to realize that, and then I had to find a way to give them that so that they alleviate their anxiety. And so one of the things that I dreamt up was, before the interview started, I'd say, what's your goal for the interview? What's a win for you? And once a guest got that, as soon as they got it out, that they saw me smile and say, yes, we could do it, they would just breathe out. And even if it happened at the end of the interview, even if it didn't happen and I linked to it afterwards, they were reassured, we're working on it together. We could fail, but we're working on it together. And so those little moments of what can we do to make the guest's anxiety go away, to understand their psychology, to make another person see that we see them and care about them so they care about us, is what I try to do throughout the life of my interviews. And so whenever something wouldn't work, I would come back and say, not what's wrong with this guest, but what can I improve about the process? And I'd experiment in the next interview and the next and the next. And when I found something that worked, like what's a win for you, asking people about their goals, I put it into a guide that I kept for myself. When it comes to the outline of the interviews, it was interviews would just go random. And sometimes it would be helpful, sometimes not. I often wouldn't be enough invested in somebody to care about their challenges, or often would see no challenges. And then I would think, well, then I'm not relating to them because they have no challenges. I don't feel like them. I said, how do I structure this well? And I learned that the reason we care about a hero in a movie is because the writers took time to get me invested in who they were before the action happened. And once I tell you this, you're going to see this in every movie and TV show just about. The first scene is like, you're going to care about this person. You're going to see them playing with their kids, taking their kids to school. You're going to see them maybe try really hard at school, and maybe the teacher doesn't listen to them, and maybe their friends aren't friends with them. In that first thing, they're relatable. You are invested in them. And then the next thing is something happens that makes us like stand up and go, whoa, we're now on an adventure. So maybe they get kicked out of school. Maybe whatever it is, right? Maybe it's the CIA, it turns out, planted a microchip in their brain. And now we're on a journey to understand how that happened. So I did the same thing with my guests. I would start them off with something like, they were in their office and they actually hated their job because all they had to do was spreadsheets, and they imagined when they got into finance that they would get to make these Wall Street, the movie style trades, but instead they're just doing spreadsheets. And they can't get themselves to quit because they don't know what else to do. And then their boss calls them in and they think, okay, finally I'm getting the promotion. And their boss says, I'm sorry, but we can't give you the bonus this year because we're not doing well as a company. And they think, this stinks. My life isn't in my hands. I don't love it, and I'm not making enough money. I think it's time to quit. And they quit. Now we care about them. Now we want to hear about the rest. Now we want to know why they started that startup. And it doesn't feel like just a product hunt listing. It feels like somebody who we care about, who we maybe could be.
Yeah, I think that happens when you connect intuitively with someone in the moment. But I love the process and the way you broke that down and was able to create that. You know, you mentioned your book, and I was actually reading through it prior to this, mm-hmm. and I am literally saying to myself, holy smokes, did he write this for me, myself? Like, this book is the book that it should probably say at the top, to Danny. And then signed you. It's like a personal letter. And I was reading through it. I'm like, I need to get the copy. I need to talk to, I need to sit down with this.
I feel like you did that. Like, by going back to what happened when I was in that college library where I felt like a loser, there's some sense of that, that people, if they are at all ambitious, and I know your audience is, they feel that too, the sense of everyone else is doing this other thing. Everyone else is, right? And here I am doing this thing that feels like me. And I know that they're going to relate to that on some level. And now we've got someone that we can listen to because we want them to do well. We want to hear what's going on.
Yeah. And the reason why I do that transparently is because I want you to know, and I want the guests to know, I really care about you. I see you. I paid attention to your story. I went deep on your research, and I care. And hopefully the audience and the guest will both see that, feel at ease, and let me do my thing from there on.
I have learned that the interviewees who don't let a host do their thing, if the host is experienced, it ends up being an uncomfortable thing to listen to. You need to just say, I'm here for your show. Let me do it. And we've seen that, obviously, right? Late night talk shows, right? If a CEO somehow ends up on a comedy talk show at night, they're going to have to be a little bit funny and let the host do their thing, even if they don't fully get the joke. Just go in with it. Ideally get the joke, but go in with it and trust that you're in a good place.
Have you watched late night TV? Mm-mm. Recently, because it is so forced. After listening to podcasts, after seeing two real people connect with each other, it's very difficult for me to watch like a fake created conversation.
Truthfully, I very rarely was able to watch any of that stuff. I did listen to Charlie Rose for a while when I started becoming an interviewer. I said, let me see how he has good conversations.
Because?
Yes, because I didn't know how to have good conversations. I was talking about like what type of woman I'm into. someone said, oh, you must love blondes because your wife is blonde. I go, no, if you really were to look at my life, I always liked, the women always look different. The girls always look different. But they had one thing in common. They're always socially precocious. They knew how to talk to adults. They knew how to talk to the teacher, talk to other parents. And I realized it was because I didn't know how to do that. I didn't. It was such a mystery. How do people operate? Why do people do the thing they're doing? And you see that sometimes with some leaders. They don't know why someone doesn't show up into the office. They don't know why someone decides to do the work and someone doesn't, you know? And they just keep thinking about it from some kind of logical, robotic point of view. Like, I'm paying you. You should be doing it. But once you understand why someone does it, or how to bring up in a conversation why they do it, how they do it, once you do that, it's just like the mysteries of the universe open up, you know? Like, now you're facing something that matters. And so that's why I cared about Charlie Rose. That's why I cared about all these other people.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because I was obsessed with Joe Rogan. And on looking back at why I was obsessed, it was because he had the ability to communicate with anyone effectively. And yeah, that is a skill I wanted. And that's clearly a skill you wanted as well in the,
yes,
in looking at blondes. So how did you realize, like, okay, that's a skill I want? And then how did you begin to tackle that? Or was it just a subconscious process?
It was a few things. It was, I finally got a job on Wall Street when I was in college. This was different than the one we talked about earlier, where my boss hired me. And then I think I asked about the salary and she said, well, you don't get paid anything. It's an internship. And I said, okay. I didn't know how to ask for money because I didn't know how to speak up and do it properly. And then one time after making endless like stupid charts and phone call sheets and making calls to schedule people for nonsense, she said, come with me. We're going to go have breakfast with some potential clients. We're going to really entertain them, and they're going to want to do business with us. At the end of this, they're going to love us, and you're going to see they're going to sign up. So I go, great, a real responsibility. I'd like to see how sales is done. I get in there, and I sit next to everyone, and it's a room full of people who are really impressive, who she now got as potential customers, and she's talking to them, and I'm sitting next to someone, and I don't know what to say to him. I don't know how to have a conversation. I don't even know who he is. What do we say that you don't screw up her relationship and actually enhance it? And she's literally with her elbow pushing me when people aren't looking. You're here to talk. Stop like dragging the conversation. And I don't know what to say. She finally, once it's done, she's because she worked on Wall Street, this is Stephanie Winston. She says, Andrew, you're pretty terrible. And I acknowledge it. And I thought, okay, she's going to make me better. But she didn't. She didn't do anything with me. She didn't give me better work. She didn't invite me anywhere else. It was just, that was it. Meanwhile, I saw these idiots who weren't doing well in school, who didn't understand the first thing about finance, get these jobs that paid so much per hour, so much. And I was so angry. I was so disappointed. I was so left out. And I said, I know that this doesn't matter, but I've got to get good at it. And truthfully, it does matter. I was putting it down because I didn't understand it, but it does matter. And I had to find a way to get good at it.
Well, you clearly got good at it real quick because in 2003, you had built up a massive company where you were the lead salesperson at Bradford & Reed.
Yes.
And so what did you do in that period of time from working on Wall Street to building up Bradford & Reed to become such a better salesperson and such a better communicator in that time?
You know, truthfully, I wasn't a great conversationalist. I wasn't great with people. What I was just really obsessed with the business side of things. And I was okay at that. I'd taken Dale Carnegie's class. I'd worked for Dale Carnegie. Dale Carnegie's a person who wrote How to Win Friends and Influence People. And so I learned. What I did better than all that was, I mean, not better than all that. What got me all those sales was just the willingness to call up and to pitch and to know that you can put out absurd offers and have people potentially accept it. Absurd offers like to call up somebody and say, will you sponsor and I'll give you 100% of your money back if the sponsorship doesn't work. This was when we were doing just email newsletters. with the idea that, of course, that's a good deal. It doesn't seem right. You seem like a sucker, but let's offer that. Let's see if you could do it. The opportunity to, if there was someone that I wanted to work with just because I read their book or whatever, to just reach out to them and say, I want to do something with you. I want you to write for me. I want you to sell for me, whatever it was. And, you know, I had the sense that there wasn't a wall between me and other people in the world, that I could reach out to just about anyone and put out an offer to them. And I got that a lot through biographies, through just reading biographies and seeing the insane stuff that entrepreneurs were willing to do to get the sale. And I was willing to do that.
Did any in particular of those stories stick out in your mind and you go back to as an example?
I've got to go back and find this story because Kara Swisher, I think in her book on AOL, she wrote two books about AOL. One was like The Rise and the other was The Fall. She should actually just repackage them as a case study, like The Rise and Fall of America Online. But in one of them, she talked about how Steve Case wanted to make a deal with someone and he basically camped out at their office. Now, she might have just been using that phrase without specifically meaning that he sat in with a tent. But in my mind, at first I saw a tent and then I saw a man who just sat down at a desk and just kept working until, you know, they saw him and heard him out. And she attributed a lot of his success to that kind of willingness to put it out there. And I realized, oh, yeah, you could just show up in someone's office unannounced. You could just say, let me stay here and do what I can to make this work. And that there's a group of people. They're your tribe, they're my tribe, they're us. And we don't feel threatened by that. We don't feel like this is inappropriate. We feel like, oh, another one of ours. Now, he hasn't exactly hit the mark, but he's willing to sit here in front of the office. She hasn't sent the right email, but she's trying. She's actually sending something that's meaningful, and she's persisting, and I can't say no to that. I like that. So that it came from there.
In 2015, you got a video message, and you were saying no to every interview, but this woman sent you a very particular video message that you said, oh, I have to be on this woman's podcast. And that is exactly what you're talking about. I just got chills because you were just talking about the inspiration and the balls and the chutzpah, to use a Jewish word, of someone who is willing to take a stab where they might not get the response. And that example happened to you directly. How crazy is that?
Yeah. So it feels good when that happens. And I think that a lot of people feel that they shouldn't do that. And the benefit of having conversations with other entrepreneurs is you get to see that this stuff is all okay. You get to see that this is the way the world works for some people, and it's helpful.
So continuing on the Bradford and Reed story, you became a top 20 most visited site in the world. At one point. How exactly did that happen?
Yeah.
It was number 19, to be specific.
What we did was, I think that was the grab.com day when...
It was.
I think, right, where we had this idea of what if you do a $1 billion jackpot? And what put that in my head is there's this company called SCA. They insure things like the hole-in-one challenge where you win a bucket of money if you get a hole in one, where if you could shoot from half court and sink a basket at a big basketball game, then you get a bunch of money. They insure all that. Well, I saw them at a conference and they said, we can insure even a $1 million contest for your website. We're trying to get people to do contests on their sites because that's how we get paid. And I thought, how about if we do a $1 billion competition? And the guy who we were with actually, it turns out, he said yes, but we didn't know it until after we sent the check. He found a way to make it happen. But he was so weird inside his company that people didn't believe it. He said he danced around with the check we sent him around the office to show that he was right and they were wrong. And they love that kind of attitude. They love that brash personality there. And so we offered it there, and the fact that it was a $1 billion contest made everybody take notice. And it wasn't easy to put together. No one wanted to insure it, even though it made sense logically. We were willing to pay a lot of money for it. And then the person who runs the company, or ran it, I don't know if he still does, he was a world champion bridge player, I think, and he definitely played with Warren Buffett. And so he reached out to Warren Buffett and said, you make logical deals, even if there's a chance that the whole thing could fall apart. Why don't you take a look at this? And Warren Buffett put Ajit, who I think now is running Berkshire Hathaway on this thing. And I remember he was the one who signed all the agreements, I think. This is all memory, but yeah, that did it. And so once we got them on board saying, yes, we will back it, we will pay the $1 billion if somebody wins, then we were able to just promote the heck out of it and did well.
How did that work exactly?
You had to pick 7 numbers out of 77. And if you pick the right 7 numbers, that they're, that a third party, you know, kind of did one of these ball things where balls pop out. I think if you picked the right 7 numbers, you won $1 billion.
It's fascinating. Oh man. How did you come up with, so the idea was just from the genesis of seeing something at the stand. What I noticed from your story is just how open you are to change and to pursue something new and interesting. Is that correct from your perspective? And if so, where does that come from?
I am. I'm always looking for something big. I have to say, like, since we're talking a lot about all the good things I've done, I have to say that lately I haven't been enough in experimental mode. I haven't experimented. We were just talking about for publishing the book, Ben from Damn Gravity, the publishing company, said, you know, I have this idea. What if we partner up with Racket? Racket is this like short form audio app that I like the content on it. So what if we partner up with them and say that we will help get their people to do interviews on their platform, and that could help drum up some interest in the book, which I should say is called Stop Asking Questions. And I realized as we were talking to him, I really love the app, but I never published a thing on Racket. And I think that's true for a lot of platforms. And so I think that there's some kind of experimentation that I need to get back to, and I'm definitely not doing enough of.
How do you get back to it?
Truthfully, I think what I want to do is take some space away from everything. I think I want to take a little bit of time and just think or not think and do something that has nothing to do with work and then come back. Olivia, my wife, asked me last night, what's your goal with the book? And she said, well, are you trying to get more customers, more subscribers? Are you trying to grow sales from it? And I said, what I really want is to just take everything that I've learned from doing these interviews and just codify it, put it down somewhere, and then take a breath. And I think that that's it. It's not so much about growing sales or anything. It's about just saying, here, this is what I've done over the last few years. It's organized. It's something that other people can take and use in conversations. And I think once I've done that, I can then say, I don't know, I'm going to go do long distance swimming, long distance bike rides, something. I don't know, play chess endlessly.
You know,
online.
I really got a sense of purity from the book and from the project itself. It wasn't like I'm trying to grab this money, I'm trying to grab this attention. It was like, from my perspective, outside looking in, it was, this is the things that I've done, 2,000 interviews. I'm not sure if that's accurate. More than 2,000 episodes. I don't know if it's more than 2,000 interviews. And it's like, here, you could learn something from it. And then diving into it, I'm like, oh man, I'm so grateful for this book because this is my Bible now. Like, this is the fact that you had Joe Rogan's transcript printed out.
Ah, yeah.
And you could see, it seems like it's random, but it's actually a process and a science. That is me. But that is me with 20 years of experience or 10 years of experience in building something. So I just want to say from
that
the bottom
of my heart, that was
surprising to me. I'm grateful.
Thanks for saying that. You know what? I listen to Joe Rogan and a few others, and to me it felt like they were just meandering around. And it wasn't until I had his and other people's interviews transcribed that I could actually see the way that they think, the way that they talk. Now, the reason that I point out Joe Rogan, I'm glad that you brought him up, is I've done that with others, but I know that others edit. And so you can't really see what builds to what and gets you to the result, right? With Joe Rogan, you can actually see this famous interview that he did with Elon Musk where Elon Musk ended up smoking weed. It seems like it meanders anywhere. It's just a couple of guys having conversation. But you can really see, and I did it second by second, you can see he's talking about one thing, they're talking about another, and he's hunting for a topic that's interesting. When Elon Musk gives him an answer that he'd given before, Joe Rogan completely dumps out of the conversation and switches topics. He even says, let's not talk about that and move on. And then I think it takes them maybe 2 or 3 minutes to hit on a topic that's good. And when they do, then they go into it for 20 or 30 minutes. Then they hunt again and hunt again. And you can't do that with a lot. There are very few interviews you could do it with that are recorded and published. And whenever they are, it's wonderful to do it. What I'd suggest is anyone who's having conversations with their clients, I suggest if you do it on Zoom, Zoom lets you automatically record. All the software lets you automatically record and signal to the other person. It's kind of weird when you record a conversation that's a sales call, right? So what I do is I say, I'm recording this because a lot of people have asked for a copy of what we said so that they have it. I'll record it and I'll send it to you afterwards. Once they see that there's a benefit for them, they acknowledge that it's there and we could always pause. And the reason that I say you should try recording your conversations is there are services now that will, Danny, record, will transcribe for free. Basically free. Otter.ai will do it for practically free. $20, you get tons of them. And what you could see is, how do you, at your best, get somebody to have a great conversation with you? If you're talking to a client, what is it that you said in the beginning? What is it that you said afterwards? How do you then close the sale? What is it that you did that where you failed? So you can go back and just scan it quickly and realize your best work and do it again and see where you went off the rails and undo that. I'll give you an example of something that I learned. I started to, Sachit Gupta is a guy who sold a bunch of ads for us, and then at some point he said he doesn't want to sell ads. Actually, I need to figure out what he's up to now because he's taken a break. I started selling ads myself and I realized we're getting so deep into work conversations right off the bat that people don't have a care for me. They're not at all invested in me. They want numbers and I want to give them numbers and all, right? So, and how do I get them to personal? I tried on some conversations, say, what's going on in your life? Or where are you? And they won't go into the personal because it feels like out of place in the conversation. So then I got methodical. You know, I kept testing and seeing the transcript and see what works. So I decided that before every phone call, I would just take a second and think about one random personal thing that happened in my day. And then I would just like act like that was top of mind. I had to bring it up. So I would talk to a client and I'd go, you know, I'm sorry, I'm a little distracted because my son just left his t-shirt here. He was unhappy with his t-shirt from when he was 3 years old. He's so proud now that he's 4 years old. He's strutting like a guy who just won the lottery, right? And then we talk a little bit about that. And now I've given them room, since I've gotten personal, to tell me about what's going on in their lives. And by doing that, we get to know each other a little bit and have something to reach out and talk to them apart from work. So those little things, when you do them and they work, if you can realize them, you could continue to do more of them.
It's having a sense of vulnerability. And even at such a small level of talking about your child, it really hits at the other person. And when you're willing to share more vulnerable stuff, like, listen, I was depressed, I was dealing with this or that, then people really get a sense of letting their guard down. And so I'm curious, yes, for you, was there a specific moment when you were particularly vulnerable on one of your 2,000 plus podcasts that it made an impact and you were like, wow, I didn't expect to share that, but that really made an impact?
You know, I used to walk around with those vulnerable points all the time and regret them. It's amazing. Now I actually can't even think of one. And the reason is that I hired this interview coach to go through my transcripts with me every week. I admired Inside the Actor's Studio. They did these interviews that were deep with actors who usually are on script. And they would cry sometimes and all that. And I said to him, his name was Jeremy Carrick, and I said, Jeremy, I hate that I go vulnerable. All these podcasters and YouTubers constantly show how great they are, and they're building their reputation by being great. I hate that I'm doing this. And meanwhile, the guest is using me to show how great they are. And all I'm doing is talking about my failures, my flaws, and they get to talk about how great they are. And meanwhile, I'm like the loser in the party of this whole internet popularity. And Jeremy looked down at my transcript, didn't respond to me. And I thought, this guy doesn't even care about me. And he just kept looking and reading the way he did every week. And then he finally said, Andrew, if you scroll down here, and you know in Google Docs you have to double tap someone's face to jump to where they are. So I scroll down and looked. He goes, look, right over here, you tell them something personal about yourself. I said, yeah, and look, she didn't give me anything about herself. I was doing it because I wanted her to be open. It's not about me. goes, yeah, yeah, she didn't. But if you scroll down, you can see how she's talking later on about her mom and how aggressive her mom was in pushing her and how tough it was for her. I said, yeah. He goes, Andrew, you expect that when you get vulnerable, people are going to respond right away? And when it doesn't happen in a transactional format, you feel like a loser? I think you should just stop thinking about this in a transactional way. It's not like ordering falafel in Bleecker Street. You have to actually just be open, trust that some people will be open back at whenever they're comfortable, and understand that many people will not. But he said, as I go through your transcripts, I see this. You get vulnerable here. Give it some time. They get vulnerable later. The reason that these conversations in your interviews end up going into such personal territory that really brings out who the person is because you do that. And it won't happen right away, and it won't always happen, but you have to accept it. And I absolutely have. And now I no longer think about it. It's no longer an issue.
You no longer think about what?
My being vulnerable with a guest and whether or not it was big vulnerable and whether or not they responded.
So could you share a moment when that happened? Like, what'd you say to make that person feel that sense? If you can remember.
I think that talking about dating was a big one. It was a big, like, failure of mine. And one of the things that I did was, in high school, I wouldn't go and talk about dating. I wouldn't try to ask anyone out, because if anyone saw that I failed, then I would feel like they would know that I was a loser. They would think I was a loser. So by keeping it mysterious, I could preserve this feeling of, I don't know, success or lack of failure, not be stigmatized. And so I didn't do it at all. And that was such a personality flaw. It was such a mistake, because I held back on myself because of what other people thought, and I didn't realize that I was doing it. And by talking about that, I immediately imagined people in my high school and elementary school who would think, I knew he was a failure, or I didn't realize, but it turns out he was. I don't know why. And so that was super personal. And then what I always think about with that is it toxic masculinity to talk about my dating challenges? And so all that combination of, what does it mean for me? What are people going to think? Is this actually somehow sexist? That used to play on my head a lot. And I wouldn't feel it in the moment of the interview, because in the moment of the interview, I'd have to say, no, I'm here to do work. And if I just take my mind off of the conversation for a moment, I'm going to fail. But then I'd go for long distance runs, and it would just go over my head over and over and over again.
Do you still feel as if it is toxic masculinity to talk about your dating struggles?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's me talking about myself, but I think that there's a concern that what if other people think that? You know, I don't want to be part of this entrepreneurial world where we create all, where we only tell stories about masculinity, or tell stories about that only other men could relate to, and then we wonder, why are there no women listening to us, right? But at the same time, I have to talk about myself, or else I'm just talking about people I don't know. And so it's a balancing act.
It's weird, right? Because you are inherently biased to yourself in what you look like, mm-hmm. but how do you get over that? How do you minimize the bias that you personally have in terms of picking guests or?
I hate to admit it, but what we do is we make an effort to find people who are not like me. And a reason I hate to admit it is because I'd like to say that we're completely blind. But I have to say that if you sent me two different offers to do an interview and you just changed one of them from a woman to a man, we might actually, as a team, maybe say no to the man, but say yes to the woman first, because we're trying to do it. If you did the same thing with an international entrepreneur, someone who is outside of Silicon Valley, I'd be much more likely to say yes to. Someone who's outside the US, I'd be much more likely to say yes to. And the reason is that for a long time, I would blow people off. I learned a lot from Martha Stewart's. I love Martha Stewart's story. She was so good at, she didn't just create a media company. She called it Martha Stewart Omnimedia. She wanted to be on every media platform, right? And she did it so well, repurposing content. So I read these books about her, and I felt like, all right, if everyone's condemning her for going to jail for insider trading, that means they're all ignoring the good stuff. I'm going to go and pay attention to the good stuff. So I learned a lot from her. I learned a lot from Harry Helmsley, from what was her name? Oh, man, I used to obsess about this woman. Is it Roberta Green? No, Hedda Green. She used to walk around Manhattan looking like a witch because she'd wear old clothes. She would go into bankers' offices and I think sit on their floors and clip coupons, literally. She became incredibly rich, and because she dressed so poorly, and because maybe she was a woman, no one paid attention to her. Their stories are fascinating of how you can be really rich by not innovating, by not spending, by staying focused. She's just an amazing story. I learned a lot from her as much as I did from a man, but I have to admit that there are people in my audience who would email me and say, Andrew, I am not in the U.S. I'd like you to talk to people who are in my country. I'd like you to talk to people who are more like me. I relate more. And so when the market demands that much and the market's not asking for something evil, it pays for me to offer it. It pays for me to say, all right, I get it. And surely what happened was when I finally interviewed people in India, for example, I remember I interviewed this one entrepreneur. I wish I could remember which one it was in India. And I thought to myself, we're all online. It doesn't matter where you are. The only thing is pain in the ass to talk to someone in India because I have to adjust my time to do it. I record the interview with him, and he somehow says he and his partner had to split. Like, one of them would stay awake at night so they could use a computer, and the other would be awake in the day so they could use the one computer. And I said, just one computer, dude? You're just making it up to sound like it's difficult, like you had nothing to build the rags to riches story. And he said, no, we didn't have a computer. And I remember in that interview saying, if anyone else out there does not have a freaking computer, I will send you a computer if you're an entrepreneur and need to do this nonsense. And there were people who reached out to me who said they were in a similar situation. Not anyone took me up on the computer, but they all said, this is what our world is like. And I realized I didn't know that. So yeah, I'm glad that I do it. And that's one of the things that I do to be a little bit more even-handed and to represent entrepreneurs everywhere. And I accept that I'm not doing it well enough.
I love it. And on that talk about Martha Stewart, you said, everyone's focusing on the bad, so I'm going to focus on the good. What mm-hmm. made you say that?
I think that for a long time when it came to entrepreneur books, the authors had to take a negative tone. They would spend their days, weeks, lives writing books about them, and they couldn't uncover the good. And so it was just like, here's another bad thing, here's another bad thing. And so one example of that is right now, Adam Newman, the guy who created WeWork. There's a ton of like, how do you do this type of books on him. I'm reading The Cult of WeWork because the author was offered to me as a guest. I said no because it doesn't fit, but I asked for the book anyway and they sent it. I'm loving the book, but it's all a put down. And it is shocking the things that this book uncovered that he would do. He would buy a plane for his company, even though it's really his own personal plane. His wife would ask that whoever it was who controlled the cell towers in New York City move one of them so that it wasn't next to her house because she didn't want to deal with electromagnetic this or that. She had like all this stuff done. Great. That really makes for a shocking, gossipy story. And that should come out because if there's bad governance, we should know about it and we should know next time that's not how you run a company. But isn't it worth a little bit of time to say, let's dissect how he got people motivated with this concept of we. What was it about the way that he talked? Was it a fast rhythm? Was it him using people's names? Was it that he put his arm around you? What was it about him that you could teach me that got him to convince some of the richest people in the world and some of the poorest people in the world that his vision was worth following and investing in? Spend time on that, and no one's going to do it because we have this heroes and goats vision of the world. Sorry, I'm going on a rant here. I heard that, I'm not a football viewer, but I heard that the NFL really took off when the broadcasters learned that with each play, they needed to find a hero or a goat. Somebody who was the person who was amazing there, someone who was the goat, who like, look at this flaw that they did. Because we are entertained by that. We want to have these people that we root for, these people that we feel better than. And so that's the way that all business is presented, heroes and goats. Martha Stewart can't be a great entrepreneur who made a mistake. She has to be a hero or a goat. And the author of the book has to have that point of view. Is she a hero or a goat? If she's a hero, show me the heroic. If she's a goat, make sure that when you show me the heroic, you also take a few shots at her. Same thing with Adam Newman. He's an absolute goat in the media, right? Why don't we just say, forget about him. Let's be selfish. What can we learn from how he did it? What can we learn from how he spun it? Let's take that approach.
There's such passion behind your words.
Thanks, yeah.
How does one maintain that level of passion throughout their life?
I'm very energetic as a person, like super energetic. It doesn't fit within the school system. Like I couldn't sit, I was ostracized. I was told that this was wrong. One of the things that my dad did that I really respected and appreciate was when the school said, your son can't sit still, he said, can we work out a deal? He was always a negotiator. He said, how about if my son sits in the back of the room? And it was like back and forth, but he eventually got to that. And I got to sit in the back of the room and I could stand all I wanted, right? And I would always sit, and I want to do that now in this interview, with one foot kind of under my thigh. That way I could also stand up when I need to. And so a large part of the world doesn't accept that. What we did was with our kids, I sent my kid to a public school in San Francisco. And it wasn't until COVID that I understood how much of a mistake I was making, because they went into Zoom and this freaking kid had to sit down in Zoom rooms for longer than I do. And he had to sit. He couldn't stand. He couldn't adjust, right? And I thought, oh, this is a mistake. And so we switched him to a school that was more outward bound type of school. He started hiking, learning on hikes. He would walk, and then he would be told, all right, here we're going to tell a story that's going to teach you something. And he was much more receptive to learning that way. I think that we're not valuing the energy that we have in us, and we put it down. So I think that one of the things my parents did that was great was they valued that kind of energy.
Where does the humility come from to say, I potentially made a mistake here, and the decision that I made previously to send my kid to this school isn't the decision I'd like to make in the future? A lot of people would double down, but you said, no, like, this isn't what I want, and we're going to change direction here.
I would have really accepted it because everyone told me it was the best school, the best public school in San Francisco. You're so lucky to have gotten in, all that. We weren't spending money on it. Before that, for preschool, we were basically, I said that it was like crashing a Tesla every year for what we're sending kids to school for, right? And so suddenly we're in there. We would have maybe accepted it, except that I complained and talked about how bad my schooling was. And I cannot talk so much and then be so opposite of that. So I talked a lot about how much it sucked that school forced me to sit down. Sometimes we worry a lot about how big our audience is. And there's like, all we need is an audience of one. A lot of podcasters think no one's listening. As long as you're listening to your guests and you like what the guest is saying, right? They would have spent an hour with you if you're someone who's really worth spending time with. Forget about who's listening in your audience. For me, it was just, who cares how many people listened to me rant about how much my school sucked and they forced me to sit down, as long as I heard. And so once you say it and say it over and over again, it becomes something that you naturally fight against when you see it in real life.
What's something that surprised you about being a new parent or a parent in the past, recent
past? That I liked it, that it was, I expected that I wouldn't relate to my kids until they could logically respond. Right now, they're old enough that they could logically respond. I felt that I even got the baby part. It was so freaking easy. So easy, the baby part. And every freaking person in my life who had a kid acted like it's the hardest thing ever. You don't understand, It was much easier. How hard is it? It's definitely time consuming. That's a pain, but it's not hard. And I'm convinced now that we had a colicky kid, but it's not hard. It gets harder later.
So it's easy. Like, what in particular made it so easy?
That I wasn't stressing it. That I knew who I was, I think. That was the hardest part. I knew who I was by then. I wasn't trying to figure it out while I was trying to be there for the kid. But I'll tell you one thing that we did. I'm now known in the family for doing this. I took the baby before he was 6 months old. I held him in my arm. I had one diaper in my back pocket and then a wet wipe, a couple of them, in a Ziploc bag so that it wouldn't wet my back pocket. And we'd go walking through the city together. And I would listen to audiobooks, or I would just look around, whatever. We'd just walk through the city. How hard is it to clean a diaper? You know what? I used to hear that men would not clean diapers. It's so hard. Dude, if you've ever spilled coffee on your table, you've done more work than it takes to clean poop from a diaper or from a butt. Because coffee will spill everywhere, go all over. The poop, it's just in the crack. You wipe, you're done.
That is on the list of something I did not expect to hear today, is Andrew Warner talking about cleaning poop off his baby. But
give people the tips. It's much easier than they think. It's much easier.
I love it, man. So before we come to a close, I would love to just hear your input on someone pursuing the highest version of themselves, whether that's physically, spiritually, mentally, through interviews. That's how I'm doing it. But what is your advice to someone pursuing the highest version of themselves?
To kind of be like my teacher at Dale Carnegie. This guy, his name is Dave Stachowiak. We've reconnected on Twitter. He starts like saying like in like every like sentence that like comes out of his mouth. Now, this is a guy, Dale Carnegie is known for writing a book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. But he wrote that book based on his course on public speaking. The main Dale Carnegie class is about public speaking. They're going to teach you how to persuade people. And they're amazing at it. So when the instructor like says like every like other word, you think something's up here. And then he said, I learned this from Bonnie, my wife. I have to work on it. And we say, why? He goes, Bonnie was teaching kids in a school. And the kids were like saying like all the time. It became part of their conversation. She then picked up on it. And then she said it and he picked up on it and he said it and he had to struggle against it. So why am I saying that? I feel like we become the people we're surrounded by, whether we know it or not. And even if we don't want to be, we are influenced by them. They are like little bugs in our brains and they can bug us to do the good thing. And we go, oh, I have to get up and do this thing because that's the way it is. You know, you don't even know that it's that person in your head who says, get up before 6 o'clock. You don't even know that it's some Tim Ferriss statement about how you have to make your bed that makes you get up and make your bed, even though all you want to do is get coffee or go to the bathroom, right? You don't know, but it's in your head. And so I think it's pick the people in your head. And I remember you had this experience when you were a kid. You started writing about sports, and then you got to go to an NBA media game. Am I right? Yes. Now you're in the room with them. I don't know if you remember how like amazing it is to realize these aren't just people on TV. I could be in the room with them. I could be in their world. What I love about interviewing is you could reach out and talk to anybody. You could be in their world, and that's true today. I think that that's true beyond interviews. You could actually reach out to some people and have a conversation with them. You could reach out to someone and work and intern for them. But what I'm saying is if you pick the people who then get in your head, they'll like have an impact on you beyond what you can realize and on the people that you interact with. And so that's the amazing thing. Find a way to be around the people that you admire and recognize that they're much more accessible than you think they are. Well, and frankly, to bring up my book because I want to promote Make Ben Happy, that's the whole goal behind Stop Asking Questions. What are the non-intuitive ways to get conversations with people we admire and then to get them to be more open and to give us their best so that we become more like the people we admire?
I am certainly better off for having you in my ears and on my screen today. Thank you, Andrew, for taking the time. We should direct people the book, Stop Asking Questions. Go get it. Go buy it. Where can people get it? And tell us.
Right now, I'm getting a couple of beta readers to come and read it. Anyone who's listening should go and register to be that. It's at stopaskingquestions.co. And then, of course, it'll be in all your favorite bookstores, as long as they're the ones that I like.
Awesome. Thank you for coming on, Andrew. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Danny.
Thank you, as always, for listening until this point in the episode. It means the world to me. I'm tremendously grateful for the fact that you got to this point. And if you got to this point and you enjoyed this episode, let a friend know that you enjoyed it as well, whether that's a tweet, whether that's an Instagram share, whether that is literally taking your phone out, pressing the share button to this episode and going to a friend and texting it to them right now. That would mean the whole wide world to me. Thank you, as always, for listening. And if you have any thoughts, you can let me know on Twitter at Hey Danny Miranda. Been a pleasure. I will see you guys in the next one. Peace.